The first case this afternoon is 25-10962, BP versus Burke Burnett Independent School District.
Thank you. Appreciate being here, Your Honor. And just one quick moment. I know it's my time. I'm getting a little older. I'm not sure how many more of these I'm going to come to. And I just really want to thank the panel here for all the other cases that have been come before all the various panels and the honor I have as an attorney to have argued them, because you never know which case they're going to take. So I appreciate that. And the staff in particular have been very, very kind and compassionate to me as well, and our staff. So I really want to thank that.
Thank you for that. We're very proud of our staff.
Well deserved. It's an honor for all of us to be here as Americans. Once again, may it please the court and counsel. My name is Martin Sirkill. I'm here to represent James and Jessica Pruden on behalf of their daughter, BP. You know, like any lawyer, we're storytellers. And one of the things I like to do for a minute or two is kind of set the stage. You know, who's our client? What does she look like? What is about her that makes this case unique and deserve it to be before you? There's not a lot about her in the file. So one of the things we have to talk about is what I call the inferences. Well, we know that she has autism, but there's lots of different people that have autism. There are some people that have autism that are engineers and doctors and lawyers, et cetera. But we know that's not true about her. Why? Because she's in a self-contained classroom. And what does that mean when a child's in a self-contained classroom? It means a number of things. One, they don't have the ability to take care of their daily needs. They need help sometimes toileting, washing, cleaning. They need help being directed to different kinds of programs during the day. And they need to be kept safe, because unlike the normal child who is at school, who can go through the halls and walk to class and get off the school bus and go here and there, BP can't do that. And the record reflects that she needed close supervision, not just because she was in the classroom, but when she left the classroom. And as we know, even more so when she went into the sensory room. The sensory room also tells us a little bit about her and infers something about her that doesn't not explicit in the record, that her kind of autism is neurodiverse. She's very, very sensitive to the environment. She has a poor nervous system, and she has to go to the sensory room to calm down. And that's one of the accommodations that the school district gave her. And that, of course, is well appreciated. One of the other accommodations that was unique to children like her, and obviously specific to this case, is that there was a sensory swing in the room. And the swing is important for two reasons. One, because it's padded, which is important for kids with disabilities and autism, because not only does it keep them safe, but it also stimulates them. That's part of the padding. That's important to recognize. And then the other thing that's important, it's an important part of this case, another accommodation, so to speak, is to have a mat on the ground. So, any questions so far? I'm happy to answer any questions that may come up about anything else in the case, because there's a lot to talk about.
I guess just a couple just sort of legal questions. I appreciate the background. But the failure to accommodate is essentially the failure to observe, monitor, and watch. Is that a fair description of
the accommodation that
she was guaranteed that they knew of was that they had to monitor and that they didn't? Is that the thrust of it?
Yes. I think there's a part A and a part B to that, Your Honor. The other part that we've argued is that they had a duty to maintain the space, which is also, in essence, a kind of supervision overall to keep the place safe. But yes, that's absolutely correct.
But the gravamen here, though, therefore, you know, push back if I'm wrong, is it's a one-time ADA claim. In other words, there's no series of things that they did. So is it plausible to allege an intention to discriminate from a single incident of what could be described as inattention instead of intention, right?
Absolutely.
You accept that the burden is you have to show they intentionally discriminated. That's even more than deliberate indifference. And yet, what I'm wondering about in the complaint, it could be said to be a terrible moment of inattention as opposed to deliberateness.
Well, there are a couple things to discuss or unpack in there as the language goes. But I think the first thing I would say, typically, at the law, to produce a prima facie case of 12B6 standard, one doesn't have to show intent because intent is only necessary for compensatory damages, and we're not anywhere near the issue of compensatory damages. And there is case law on that issue that talks about that particular duty.
But you have asked for compensatory damages.
Well, we do in the complaint. We ask for compensatory. That's part of the damage model, of course, particularly post-Cummings. There's a physical injury, so that's one of the issues that we're talking about. So once again, to specifically answer the part of the question about intent is not necessary to make a prima facie case of a disability discrimination, whether it be the 504 or the ADA, because we're not at the compensatory damage model. We haven't got into discovery on damages. There's no depositions on damages. There's no medical records on damages. So the only way you could have a plausible comp, working backwards, a comp ad, a compensatory damage model and satisfy the intent requirement is to have that data. And you don't have that at the 12B6 stage. Hence, there's no reason you put that in the pleadings because you have to put that in the pleadings. But as a matter of fact, there's no way really to satisfy it in the pleadings.
What's the paragraph that you think best put it in the pleadings? What paragraph best described that the mishap here was one that was intentional as distinct from?
I might have to get that specific paragraph for you when I get my rebuttal, Your Honor.
Okay.
Thank you.
Do me a favor and remember for me.
I will. I'll write it down.
Well, then flipping around this sort of scienter question to causation, you would still have to allege that it was the motive was the disability, right?
Well, that goes to your intent question. So there's different kinds
of causation.
Well, there's different types of disability discrimination cases that we experience. So one that we have is where, let's say a child's bullied and harassed in school, and we have to show some severe and pervasive type of things like you just discussed. We have to show notice, which is an important part of that type of disability discrimination case for a child at school. A person with the ability to make changes and stop the bullying and harassment, there has to be a deprivation of educational opportunities. For a pure discrimination disability case, you just have to show, was the person disabled? Did the school district know that the person was disabled? Yes. Did the school district know that the person had limitations? They're well aware of the limitations. In fact, one of the accommodations they provided
What's the third element?
Yes. And you have to show that they failed to provide the necessary accommodation. So then the question there is, what are the necessary accommodations that this child needed? Well, she needed close supervision. And even more so, because of the sensory room and the use of the swing, she needed what was called close spotting. Now, one of the other supervisory issues in there, and one of the other accommodation issues I don't want to lose track of, was the duty to have a mat there. Because while there's a fair question from going back to causation about whether the school district would be liable under a causation standard for the swing breaking off and the child being injured during that part of the incident, clearly they had a duty to put a mat there. They knew that the swing was padded. They knew that the floor was supposed to be padded. They have other areas in the school, like playgrounds, where everything has to be padded nowadays as well to satisfy the duty to accommodate children with special needs. So once again, they didn't accommodate her with the keeping the environment safe, which there's a general duty to keep kids with accommodation with disabilities safe. Part of the school district's position has been that they don't have there's no legal duty to accommodate kids with disabilities. They called it a negligence case or a premises liability case, right? And I would argue with that is that there's school buses that take kids to and from school. There's wheelchair lifts. There's harnesses. There's all kinds of things that we take our kids to and from school with that are mechanical. We want them to be maintained. Why should only the sensory swing be the exception? We have playgrounds that we want to be maintained. We want roadways and walkways and doors and handles and everything in the school to be maintained. Let me go to a worst case scenario. There's a fire drill, and we have kids who are deaf and hearing impaired or blind. We need to make sure that all the all the sounds that go off are there. We need to make sure all the lights work to let kids know that there's a problem. We need to make sure the walkways are safe. Having a safe school for kids with disability is not just a wish, it's actually written into the law. The ADA has a particular section at 28 CFR 36211, and I'll read it because it's that simple. Public accommodation shall maintain in operable working conditions those features of facilities and equipment that are required to be readily accessible to and usable by persons with disabilities. And that has been incorporated by reference into a Fifth Circuit case, Frame versus Arlington, meaning that school district, going back to your first question, so it was only half the story. The other half of the story is they had a duty to keep this environment safe, and they didn't do it. And the duty is written into the law. So
is that,
I would, go ahead, Your Honor.
Does that amount to strict liability? Is that?
I would say this. No, because strict liability is different than the duty I have to have a plausible claim at the 12B6 standard.
I'm just saying if you negligently failed to maintain or there was a spill on the floor, it was there long enough for you to know it and you didn't see it. I mean, I'm just trying to, I mean, does the statute say?
The short answer is I'd have to go back to the plain reading of the code. It says a public accommodation shall be operable working condition. So, like, we're not talking about a leak on the floor, right? We're talking about the accommodation. So the specific accommodation to this child was a sensory swing, and it should have been kept safe. And the records were replete with not keeping it safe. So I got 3 minutes left. So I want to go back to Judge Higginson's your first kind of question is, yes, there's a failure to accommodate issue. We don't believe that at this stage of the litigation we have to show intent or even deliberate indifference because we're not there yet. That's for compensatory damages, and we're not even that far down the road. Once again, I think one of the big issues that I hope we can agree on, notwithstanding some of the others, is that they had a duty to put the mat down. And if they would have had a mat down, it would have mitigated the child's injuries.
So the failure to... Maybe just because you'll get back up and give me the best paragraph.
Yes. That was on intent, though.
What?
That was on intent,
yes.
Your Honor. Yes.
But then before you, right now, because you do have plenty of time still, if the theory is the failure to accommodate was the failure to keep the equipment safe or the failure to have safety mats, what's your best case where a single incident of that states plausibly a failure? What's your best case?
I would say... the federal case, Barnes versus Gorman, and then the predecessor was Barnes versus Ely. That had to do with kind of a different type of people, but that had to do with a gentleman who was arrested. He was in a wheelchair, and when he was arrested, he was taken in by the Kansas City police, might have been the county police, county sheriff. And when he was brought to jail, the van that he was in didn't have the kind of actual mechanical device to keep him safe. So that was a one-time incident. Supreme Court case that says if you don't accommodate someone's disability and they're injured, you're liable.
That's a little different here than the equipment fails. There's no suggestion they knew it was going to fail.
Actually, the case says that what they shimmied up what failed. So that would be, I would say, not the exact same, but substantially the same. They didn't have anything in place for the gentleman, so they put something together, and that failed.
But
so if they failed to accommodate...
They're on notice they need a vehicle that can move wheelchair people. They don't do it. That sounds more like intentionality, discriminating against a person with that disability. If you've got a disabled child in your care, and then the pipe holding the swing up breaks, it's much more difficult to understand why that leads to a plausible failure to accommodate claim, which I'm trying to tease out the theory of the failure to accommodate. I thought the failure to accommodate was not the sudden equipment failure, but the fact that the person watching the child.
Well, that is definitely part of the story. And
part of the story, okay.
And she wasn't.
Time's running out. What's your base case to support that as a plausible failure to accommodate? A one-time inattention. It's difficult for me to
see. That one I'll have to get back with you on for my rebuttal as well.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm Meredith Walker, and I'm here on behalf of Applee Burke Burnett ISD. From the district's perspective, the magistrate judge correctly granted the district's motion to dismiss and then correctly denied the motion for reconsideration and the motion for leave to file an amended complaint. And Judge Higginson, I want to start where you left off with respect to the causation issue, because I think that's where this case absolutely falls apart from appellant's standpoint. Because whether we look at it from the standpoint of the accommodations were providing those safety measures that are necessary for any students who access the swing, or we look at it from the standpoint of there was this alleged failure to not provide the supervision, we don't get the causation from the second one. The student could have had all of her accommodations, and her accommodations are set out and supervision throughout the day, monitoring while performing tasks, prompting, cueing, social skills, redirecting, escorts during transition, certain staff-to-student ratios, frequent redirection and assistance, close supervision, and visual supports. Even if she didn't receive all of those, and the court assumed for purposes of the 12B6 that she didn't receive any of those on that day, none of those caused the swing to fail and break. And so there's a serious causation issue, which is why I contend and the school district contends that this really is a premises liability or negligence claim masquerading as a 504 and ADA claim. And you'll see that throughout our briefing, because the following the manufacturer's instructions, providing the safety equipment, those are safety measures that all students need, regardless of whether they're a special education student or they're a regular general education student. And while not completely on point, I think that the Rude case out of the Middle District of Florida is somewhat analogous, and I think it can help the court get to the school district's position. There, the individual was asking for a certain bridge to be put over some lagoons so he could access the beach. And the court, the Middle District of Florida, said a necessary accommodation is one that alleviates the effects of a disability. For necessity, the accommodation must address the needs created by the disability. Nothing about the student's disability here, nothing about BP's disability, caused the need for safety equipment. Every student needs safety equipment. If a gen ed student was using that swing, they would need safety equipment. If a gen
when you
ed
said what, gen X?
Did, gen ed, sorry,
okay.
General
did,
education.
Did general education students use the swing?
So if you look at the amended complaint, there's no allegations regarding that. But when we argued against the motion for leave to replead under the futility, we provided deposition evidence that showed that general education students did access the swing.
But I thought in this proposed Second Amendment complaint, they also offer evidence that there were warnings that the disabled student's chair, the one she that broke and she was hurt, was in a state of disrepair. And that would could lead plausibly to the suggestion that the school's on notice that the swing for the disabled students could break, whereas the other ones were well equipped.
Right, but that, again, falls apart from the school district's perspective because the evidence with respect to arguing futility shows that other students would access that swing. The deposition testimony reflects that there were students who would come in to the sensory room and act as peer mentors, if you will, for the special education students that have access to that swing. So if we have general education students and special education students, we still don't have that intentional discrimination because of the student's disability. And I
therefore the defect would not be one of causation in that set of facts.
Correct. In that set of facts, you're absolutely correct. The defect is not causation. I think that
Following along with the intentionality, what's the best case? Because opposing counsel says this really only becomes relevant when you reach damages.
So all of the cases say that you have to show intentional discrimination if you are asking for compensatory damages. And if you look on the record on appeal at page 130, paragraph 50 of the first amended complaint, it specifically lays out the damages that they're seeking, and they're all compensatory damages. And so there's nothing left for the court to look at because they're not asking for any kind of injunctive relief here. And so compensatory damages is absolutely one of the things that the court has to take into consideration looking at the face of the pleading. And then going back to the question of causation, I think when the court looks at, there's two specific cases that I think you can really draw the distinction on what's happening in this case versus an accommodation that actually caused a student an injury, or a failure to accommodate, I should say, that caused a student an injury. When you look at the Worth case out of versus Dallas ISD, it's a Northern District of Texas case from 2021. There, the student would ingest inedible objects, and there was a specific accommodation in the student's individualized education program that the student needed to be supervised so the student would not ingest those inedible objects. And it turns out that the student was ingesting inedible objects, so nobody was supervising the student. And the student was admitted to the hospital and had to have surgery to have 6 rubber gloves removed from the student's stomach. So there you can draw that direct line of causation. The failure to accommodate by not providing the supervision directly caused the student to ingest those inedible objects, which led to the student's surgery. You can't get there on the facts before the court because, again, it's more of a negligence premises liability issue, which then also defeats the intentionality piece.
Why is it that? How do you distinguish that from the failure to provide a mat?
So a mat is not an accommodation that the student needs because of her disability. That goes back to that to the Rude case out of the Middle District of Florida. There's nothing about the student's disability that says she needs a mat. So, Judge Richmond, if the student needed a mat because of their disability, then what would happen is the student would go in, we'd put the mat there, and the student would swing with the mat. And then a general education student would come in and would say, oh, you're a gen ed student, you don't have a disability, and so you don't need a mat. That doesn't make any logical, plausible sense because, again, the manufacturer's instruction said we need to use a mat if there is a student that is swinging. And so the mat is not necessary because BP has a disability. The mat is necessary because that's what the manufacturer's instructions say, which, again, the facts are, or as pled, that there was no mat. And so at most, that's negligence for failing to follow the manufacturer's instructions. It's a premises liability issue. It's not a failure to accommodate. In fact, if you look at the accommodations in the that have been pled that were in the student's individualized education program, nowhere does it say the student needs a mat when the student is swinging. Because again, that's a safety measure, that's for all students. So again, when you go back to the Rude case and it talks about the need for the accommodation flowing from the disability is what the court should look at, as opposed to those types of accommodations, and I wouldn't even call them accommodations, I would call them safety measures that all students would need. And so I think the Worth case demonstrates that. And then also, if you look at the Brownsville case, is another case that I think you can see the juxtaposition between the position that Burnett ISD has here and where a failure to accommodate actually gives rise or causes the injury. And in Brownsville, we had a student, or there was a student who had cerebral palsy and intellectual disabilities who was participating in aquatic activities. And in that case, the doctor's order explicitly stated that the student should not put their head underwater and that the student should not hold their breath and that they needed close monitoring because of their disabilities. And then it turns out nobody's monitoring the student and the student drowns. That is a causation issue. They needed that those accommodations because of their disability, because there was a doctor's order that said the student should not put their head underwater and the student should not hold their breath. And
the
then
denial of the motion to amend.
What, I'm sorry?
On the denial of the motion to amend.
So the
court said delay and futility?
The court said delay and futility. And the court said delay because And the school district filed a motion to dismiss, and then opposing counsel had the opportunity to file an amended complaint and did, in fact, file an amended complaint with the opportunity to review where we said their deficiencies were. And that was done in November. And then depositions were taken the following February and March, including the 30B6 deposition of the school district's corporate representative. In March, they also designated expert witnesses. And it wasn't until after the court granted the motion to dismiss in April that they filed a motion for leave to amend in May. So there was no attempt after the depositions.
But the discovery deadline hadn't yet ended.
No, we were in the middle of discovery at that point, but at no point, even with the corporate rep deposition, the expert report, they didn't make any attempt to amend. But we would also argue that it's also futile to amend the complaint for the reasons that we set forth. It's still a premises liability claim masquerading as an ADA or 504 claim. And then when you get into or dig into the futility issue, and the evidence shows that the student absolutely was monitored. The testimony from the aide and the video that was provided to the court shows that the aide followed the student into the sensory room and was standing there when the student fell from the swing because the swing broke. But going back again to your causation questions, whether the aide was there or not there doesn't cause the swing to break.
Seem fairly fact-rich. My distant memory was they said, yes, the aide was in there, but the aide was busy with the cell phone. No evidence of that at all?
No evidence of that.
No allegation of that?
No. And as a matter of fact, when you look at the aide's testimony, she said, every child in our room is supervised. Are they under supervision at all times? Yes. And you probably told me this earlier, but I take it she would not have been allowed to use the sensory screen unsupervised. Is that correct? Yes, sir. And then she went on, and I'm sorry, I should have told you the record site. This is from 324 to 332. She goes on to say, I listened to her laugh. That was one of the strongest things in my head. I watched her smile. I saw the joy on her face. I was looking to the front of the room, and she would have been, so she was talking about, you know, obviously when you're swinging, you're looking at the front of the room, you're looking at the back of the room. And so that's what her testimony was. When the swing went forward, that's where my eyes were. And then when the swing wound up on the floor, she was turning to look at the back, and the swing had broken, the student had fallen. So,
and just simplistically, if a school offers a sensory room for disabled children or autistic children,
yes,
and there's any evidence that they're putting in money to make sure the swings for everybody works, but they're not, in spite of getting notices that particular one, the one primarily used by disabled children, is in disrepair. Why isn't that just enough to get past 12B6?
Because you don't have the intentionality, which
is... So now we really are just on intentionality.
That would go to the intentionality issue, which is, I believe you said it earlier, which is this is a one-time, one-off situation. And when you look at deliberate indifference...
But you can't have one-time, one-off. I forget the name of the case, the police stop, where the person, you probably know it, the person...
The Delano Pyle case?
Yes.
Yes.
So a one-stop doesn't mean you don't have a failure to accommodate. If they're aware of the disability and what the government asks the person to do in school.
Right. And where I would distinguish Delano Pyle is back to they were aware of the disability and they didn't accommodate the disability because they didn't provide the sign language interpreter in Delano Pyle.
Right.
Here, the student doesn't need the swing to be in working order because she has a disability. She needs the swing to be in working order because she's a student, just like any other student.
Okay.
And so that's where...
I'm thinking about that. It's a little hard to say if that's a swing for disabled people.
So,
and their Second Amendment complaint would say, others had said, that's the only one that doesn't work, with the implication being that for people who aren't disabled, the school will put money in, but they're deliberately, intentionally not putting money in to fix a swing that's for disabled people.
And so I think...
Would that have some level of intentionality then?
I think if there was actual evidence that somebody was on notice, and based on the evidence that we provided to the court, arguing to futility.
So that's not even in the motion to amend, they didn't even have that evidence?
No, because when you look at the evidence we responded or the school district provided in response was at the record on appeal 300 to 301, and that's talking about other students, non special education students using the swing.
Okay.
And I know it's not perfect, because I do recognize that Delano Pyle is out there, and I understand the holding of Delano Pyle, but when you look at deliberate indifference, and this court has held that it actually requires something more than deliberate indifference, but if we're just going with the deliberate indifference, and for Title IX, for Section 504, all of those claims require some kind of notice and an opportunity to remedy it. And my argument there would be that we haven't had that notice and opportunity to remedy it. And then I did also want to touch briefly, since I'm getting down on my time, to 28 CFR 35.133. That showed up for the first time in this case in the reply brief. That was never argued at the district court level. It was not in the opening brief. It just showed up in the reply brief. And setting aside whether it's properly before the court, and when you actually go and look at the appendix to 28 CFR, it's talking about making sure routes, elevators, ramps, those types of features are in good working repair so individuals can access buildings and facilities. And so one of the cases I pulled to look at that issue was the Norman case, and it's 293 Federal Appendix 284, and that's a Fifth Circuit case out of 2008. And in that case, it was a prisoner who had a disability, and he argued that there was a crack on the prison basketball court and that the TDCJ was liable under the ADA and RA because it failed to maintain the basketball court on which he was injured. And this court said, no, he hasn't provided any authority showing a basketball court is a required facility that must be readily accessible to disabled individuals. So I would, taking that to the conclusion, we don't have individuals coming off the street to a school district to access a sensory room. I just don't think, based on the Norman case and then looking at Appendix B, that is what the intent is, because again, it's talking about making sure that there's not inoperable elevators, that there's not locked accessible doors, that accessible routes are not obstructed. It talks a lot about in the case law about making sure there are curb cuts so individuals can access ramps. And then there was one other case I found on it, another Fifth Circuit case. I'm not going to get the name right, Miraglia versus Board of Supervisors, and it's 901 F3rd 565. And that case was all about doors being too narrow and ramps being too steep, so the individual could not get into the public building. So again, I don't believe that argument's properly before the court, but to the extent that it is, that would be my response to that. And with that, unless anybody has any additional questions, I will cede the rest of my time.
One, are you familiar with Phillips versus Prater?
No, I am not.
That's the security officer in the school system, not cited by the parties. Okay.
No, I'm sorry.
No.
That's not one that I pulled up. I'm sorry, Judge.
No, that's not
great. Thanks. All right. Any other questions? Thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
One, I'm going to have to apologize, Your Honor. We'll get you the ROA if we can supplement the record in the next 24 hours with the exact site. But I can tell you our amended complaint, and even the one that we asked that it be looked at on our motion for reconsideration and motion to amend, talk more about deliberate indifference, which is also a way of construing disability discrimination in the Fifth Circuit. But we do address it, but I will get you that ROA. The other thing that I'm going to have to supplement with the court's permission is, in fact, let me talk about the evidence before I get back to that one thing I want to supplement. So we filed our motion for reconsideration, and we also sought leave to amend. And the school district, in their response, attached evidence. Well, what does that tell us? What did that tell me? both factually and even legally. They attached evidence because they knew, one would have to surmise, that the record had evidence and our amended complaint had evidence that was not futile and was worthy of further litigation. And they used their evidence to disprove our facts that we pled, but not with evidence. So once again, first issue is, in my mind, why would they do that? They did it because obviously they thought there was something in it. But as a matter of law, when you have, and once again, this goes back to the 12b6 motion, when someone attaches evidence to a response or a reply or any document in a 12b6 motion, it automatically should become a motion for summary judgment. And the court should have automatically, in my opinion, and I think the law supports this, is that all the previous decisions should have been vacated and the counsel should have been permitted to either do further discovery if she wanted to, and or, of course, she could file a motion for summary judgment at any time. So I would submit to the court that just on procedural grounds alone, this case should go back because they've already opened the door to evidence. And once you open the door to evidence, I have a right to respond with evidence. That's why the law is, when you have a 12b6 motion, you attach evidence to it, it automatically transfers to a motion for summary judgment.
What pleadings did your Second Amendment complaint add that go to either causation or intentionality?
Say that. To
your what opinion. Did your proposed Second Amended complaint add that would go to either causation or intentionality? Is she correct that there was no additional allegation about being on notice that the disabled children's swing was in disrepair?
Was there no additional evidence?
In your Second Amendment
I would say, let me make sure I say this right. We filed the motion for reconsideration because we thought the judge did not follow the standards of review for discrimination based upon disability case. If you go back and read his first memorandum order, Your Honor, he uses a standard of review that's best for 1983 and a Monell
case. I'm not asking about the motion to reconsider and whether there was legal error. I'm asking whether your Second Amendment complaint adds allegations that speak to causation or intentionality.
No, but once again...
Okay, that's what I need to know.
If you're asking me if there's allegations of it, the answer is yes, and I'll send you the ROA, and we'll do both the original complaint and the amended complaint. If there's something in there that I think answers you, we'll provide it. And if there isn't, there isn't.
Well, just do your best now, having lived with the case. Am I wrong? And I often am remembering the facts for all these cases. They do just get blurred.
Right, right.
For some reason, I thought that there were additional allegations that this particular swing had the school had been taught, it was in disrepair. But that
there was a lot of allegations in the Second Amendment complaint about them being on notice to having a problem with the swing and not doing it. There's other fact, and I've got 30 seconds, there's other factual information that the person that was in the room with her testified in deposition that she didn't even see the young girl fall out of the swing. She heard it. That means that she might have been there, but she wasn't supervising. And once again, under the standards for using that sensory swing, it required spotting, it required watching, it required somebody who doesn't know how to take care of themselves to do it for them, and they didn't do that. My time's up.
Well, just to clarify that then, so the allegation is to failure to watch.
Yes.
Your allegation is based on her own deposition that she didn't see the moment of flying out of the swing. It's not that she was looking down or that she'd stepped out, or that it was the phone. The allegation is just her own comment that she heard the thud.
It's a coin with a heads and a tails. Part of the argument goes back to not having a mat there. Supervisory duty was to have a mat there because that would have mitigated the injury. The other part of the story...
Why isn't that a premises liability issue?
Why is it not?
Why is that not solely a premises liability issue, as your friend on the other side argued earlier?
Because they don't have mats every place else in the school. They have mats... That mat was a requirement for the sensory swing that's specific to that child. So we're not just talking about a general rule for everybody across the school. She had an accommodation, sensory room. They knew that. They put her in the sensory room. They sent somebody to be with her one-to-one. supposed to have a mat. They used the record shows they used the mat for kids to sleep. They didn't use it for, you know, for what it was supposed to be used for. And she was injured. They should have had a mat down. It would have mitigated the injury. And it's not a premises liability issue when it's an accommodation specific to an individual who required it. And they knew they were supposed to have it, and they didn't do it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.